Everyone has had a friend or family member who has been seriously sick, so ill that they have been admitted to the ICU or the intensive care unit of the hospital. And that can be a really stressful time for everyone. But I want you to know that you are not alone. In fact, over 5 million Americans are admitted to the ICU every year. Dion, has this ever happened to you?
Yeah. In fact, believe it or not, my mom was admitted to the ICU for severe sepsis from malaria, of all things.
Okay.
Yeah, we had all recently returned from a trip to Nigeria. And being the strong person that she is, she minimized her symptoms and waited till she was severely ill before she went to the hospital. Mm. It caused quite a stir at my hospital because we're in the middle of nowhere, Illinois. So a lot of the doctors hadn't seen malaria since med school or training. And really just in the books. But we can laugh about it now, but during that moment, it was really hard seeing my mom in that condition. And I'm sure a lot of people who have gone through that can understand it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Thank God your mom is great now, because every time I see her and then like you post pictures of all your family weddings, she looks amazing, like dancing and having a great time. I would have never guessed that she was in such a critical condition.
Yeah. I mean, she is the picture of health. Typically, you know, she's waking up at 4 a.m. to do her YouTube workouts. So she does a lot more than most of us. So it was a lot. And I think what's so hard for patients and their loved ones being admitted to the ICU, the hard part is that it's usually not anticipated. It's something that happens really suddenly. And it's hard to adjust to the rapid changes. It leads to a lot of anxiety, confusion, and stress for the entire family. So for today's episode, we asked for my good Instagram friend, Dr. Stephen Bradley, a fellow anesthesiologist and critical care doctor, to weigh in on what he thinks everyone should know to help them get through these stressful times. Stephen currently practices in Florida, where he splits his time between the operating room and taking care of patients in the ICU. He has a special interest in medical ethics and is the host of the Black Doctors podcast, which aims to mentor and educate future underrepresented minority doctors. So join us today. This is going to be really helpful conversation where we pull back the curtain on what happens in the ICU.
This is the IV Drip, a podcast designed to give you the dish on health topics you need to know but didn't know to ask. We are your hosts, Dr. Maliha Mohideen
and Dr. Deani Becky. We're both Harvard-trained anesthesiologists and besties. Join us as we explore hot topics that are rarely discussed but can have a huge impact on your life.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, we are thrilled to have you. We feel so lucky to have this brain trust to tap into. I think before you share your tips on helping our listeners navigate the terrain of the ICU, I think we should start, like, let's break down what the ICU is. And I guess more specifically, how is it different from other floors in the hospital?
Absolutely. That's a great question, great place to start. So the intensive care unit can be a real mix of very ill patients, but they all have a need for increased level of direct supervision or monitoring and care that is complex. They can be in the ICU for many different reasons, though. For example, they can have breathing problems where they need a ventilator for support. They can have sepsis, which Dion mentioned can cause multiple organ system failure. They can have brain injuries like a stroke or a bleed where doctors are monitoring their neurological function, or even a heart attack. So there are many different causes that can land someone in critical care, and often requiring multiple teams of physicians that are seeing these patients and working together to make these plans.
Right. And that's what makes it so complicated. All of these things can happen at the same time or in some combination. We saw this during COVID, when an infection would lead to severe lung disease, and then our patients would need a breathing tube and vent support. But then they'd also develop serious heart conditions due to the virus as well.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of different types of ICUs. So there's the pediatric ICUs, the PICU, the neonatal ICU. Often, you know, premature babies end up here. Mm-hmm. There's the surgical ICU, the neurological ICU, et cetera. And usually we refer to them as acronyms, where these patients are under very specialized care. There are certain types of therapies that we can only do in an ICU setting because of the monitoring that these therapies require. So patients, for example, that are on ventilators or have breathing tubes or on the heart-lung machines, commonly called ECMO,
right.
These patients need to be in an ICU. And we also recover patients after complicated surgical procedures.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there. Mm-hmm. We've dropped off patients straight from the OR. Because we knew based on our experience that, you know, because of the nature of the case, they were going to need further close monitoring, or we weren't able to take them off the vent. So we took them straight there. So there's a lot of anesthesiologist and intensivist communication and teamwork as well.
Yeah, that's so true. I think the takeaway here is that for anyone in the ICU, their condition can change rapidly for better or for worse. And that dynamic change is why there's so much monitoring that's required. Dion, do you remember covering the surgical ICU as residents?
Unfortunately,
We slept in the ICU and worked long, like 30-hour shifts, because we could not even leave the floor without notifying nursing that we were leaving the floor. Usually in those ICUs, I remember the nursing was one-to-one, meaning there was one nurse per patient. That's how much monitoring was required. Yeah. And even depending on the unit, they can even be very strict family visitation rules as well. And I think that's variable depending on the type of ICU you're in.
Yeah. So please don't trigger my PTSD. These calls were the worst. And Steven, I'm sure you can relate because I'm sure it's like universal. We didn't sleep a wink and we prayed a lot. It was not we for did. Me, but I'm so thankful that people like you, Dr. Steven, here feel called to do this type of work. So, you know, Steven is a board certified critical care doctor, and you can explain to our listeners the difference between a critical care doctor and internal medicine doctor or primary care doctor. Can you elaborate on those differences, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So critical care medicine, it requires extra training. It's a fellowship that a physician can complete only after finishing certain training programs like internal medicine, pediatrics, surgery, emergency medicine, or anesthesiology. The focus of the fellowship is to spend some time exclusively taking care of critically ill patients around the clock. Depending on the primary specialty, this training can be as little as 1 year or as many as 3 to 4 years, and that may include some research time as well. As an anesthesiologist, the critical care specialty kind of dovetails very nicely with our training.
For sure.
Yeah, I have mad respect for you for finishing residency and then wanting to take care of the sickest patients long-term. I was just glad I got through that rotation.
Yeah, same.
And, you know, after all that experience, I am sure you have some gems to share with us. You know, I have my own tips. I'm sure Dion does too. But we really want to know, what are the things you tell loved ones of your patients? So the families, the caregivers of your patients, things that you can share with our listeners so we can make the stressful experience perhaps less stressful.
I would love to. A couple of tips. The first thing that I always say is communication is essential. Hmm. When you have a loved one in the ICU, mm-hmm. it's a very stressful time. It's hard to remember everything that's going on, especially when the news is complicated and oftentimes it can be unpleasant. I encourage my patients and their family members to write things down. Going old school with a pen and paper is great. If you're using a notes app on your phone, that's an option. This encourages your physician, reminds us to slow down a little bit and explain things very simply and in perhaps more detail. Mm-hmm. It helps to have a designated family contact member for the ICU nurse and the ICU team. They can establish that when to contact the hospital if you personally can't be there for a daily check-in. It is helpful if that person has a background in healthcare, but will obviously explain things as needed.
Yeah.
Nurses are a really good source of explanations for these complicated things. Not the internet. The internet can definitely lead you down a rabbit hole. And oftentimes, you know, it may not be a big deal. We may just contact you, to obtain consent for what is a very routine medical procedure that just needs to happen, but we do need consent. So expect the potential for frequent phone calls.
Absolutely. Great point. I know we have to get anesthesia consent a lot in the ICU, and we often have to call, you know, these family members. So it's helpful if it's the same person each time so that they're in the loop for the day-to-day changes. So that's a really good tip.
Yeah, absolutely. It really helps us out. The second thing that I would say is to know the wishes of your loved one. Know who the healthcare power of attorney is, the POA.
Can you explain or just elaborate for our listeners what the power of attorney is and how important they are?
Yeah, in layman's terms, so the healthcare power of attorney is a legal document, and it kind of explains some of your wishes if you're unable to make decisions, or your family members' wishes if they're incapacitated. And it usually identifies the person that would be able to speak for them and advocate on their behalf as well. Mm-hmm. And in addition, this healthcare power of attorney will know what kind of measures that that family member would want to be performed. The terms such as DNR, DNI, which is do not resuscitate or do not intubate. Does that family member want heroic measures or efforts? And more importantly, what does quality of life mean for that person? We're all very different. What's the likelihood of recovery? And to what extent is it expected that that patient will recover?
Sure.
A living will is helpful in trying to do what the patient would want. It's important. It's the patient that we're centering and not necessarily what yourself or your family members would want.
Yes.
This could be a very stressful decision for many families, and we understand that. But understand that there are many things we can do in medicine, but sometimes we shouldn't do some of these things. Everything we do in the hospital has risk, and then it also has the intended benefits. And sometimes those risks can outweigh the benefits.
Yes. Oh my God, yes. And this is where I see, and I'm sure you all see as a physician, families really have very difficult situations, right? You know, just like how many times have we seen a grandparent, a grandma is sick, and she has expressed her wish to not be resuscitated, and like part of the family is present, and then, you know, her son understands her wishes, but then somebody's family members come out of the woodwork and they fly in and they're asking for different things and they want, you know, heroic measures. And it turns into almost like, unfortunately, it can be a lot of tension and very dramatic and everybody's in their feelings, which creates some very uncomfortable conversations and family tension. So even now, you know, right now I have had these conversations with my own husband and my parents and my siblings present. So we are all collectively really clear on who should be making decisions if one of us is in this situation, God forbid. But it's inevitable, actually, you know, for all of us. So the conversation is important and what our wishes are. And having that convo while everyone is healthy and, you know, able to have that conversation, no matter what age you are, is really helpful. So that's a great point, Stephen.
That's good that you've already done that.
Yeah. You kind of like, if you've ever done your will or anything like that legal wise, it kind of lends it. I mean, that's part of that whole like planning process. And so those conversations kind of come up, which I encourage everyone to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's great that you've already had those conversations. And this kind of segues right into tip number three, which is disposition. It's a big word for where do you go after you leave the ICU?
Yeah.
So we're often asking questions and planning ahead to determine if the patient or the family members will have the appropriate resources to provide care at home, or if they're best served going into a rehab facility for a period of time. We should also, most ICUs also have social workers available that can help family members navigate these decisions.
Sure.
Oftentimes, as a critical care physician, I may not have the most input in terms of the care plan when patients leave the ICU, but I can recommend that they go to a care facility or rehab versus home.
Absolutely. Stephen, that ties into, you know, what you were also saying earlier about knowing the wishes of your loved ones. Some patients don't want to be in a long-term care facility, or, you know, they want to be entirely independent of a caregiver. Knowing their preferences and knowing what resources are available and having realistic expectations about where they could be next and for how long is super important.
Yes. Yes, it is. And to that point, the ICU has dedicated teams to help family members navigate those decisions. Tip number four from me would be asking for these multidisciplinary meetings. These meetings help you get the entire picture of what's going on. When do the doctors round? When are tests performed? It might be helpful to establish a schedule so that you can call the same time every day if you can't be there in person for an update. But also understand that we are managing complex care for 6 or 12 or even 24 other critically ill patients that are also requiring procedures and complex multidisciplinary meetings. But we are available to help you navigate this very difficult situation.
Yes, this. It's so true. And it can be a challenge for both the doctors and the families to connect at the right time. Feels like you're just missing each other, and it can be frustrating for both the family and the doctors. That's why I think it's best to try to set up a time in advance and even reserve a conference room. That's the time to jot down your questions so you can ask them all at the same time and not as they come, because it's hard to track down the answers. But also, like you said, it's important that patients know that there are often patients and families who need the doctor and team's attention. So if a response is not quick enough, it's not that you're being ignored, but that the team is getting pulled away. So I'm glad that you kind of mentioned that.
Absolutely. And it is hard to keep track of everything because not only are things moving fast, but it's also extremely, extremely emotionally taxing, which brings me to tip number five for family members in these situations. You have to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. Caregivers should not be ignored. And even caregivers, family members, friends, loved ones can develop PTSD from experiencing these interactions with healthcare. It's exhausting. So get sleep, take shifts, you know, work out a meal plan through friends and family members. Patients also need a lot of rest while recovering. So find a meditation room or take a walk in the courtyard. Just take a break and get away for a little bit for your own mental health. Mm-hmm. Be very aware that oftentimes family presence is helpful. Sometimes it may not be. And if you're present, you may see things that you don't want to see. Things that aren't very pleasant, but must be done to improve that patient's recovery. So ask yourself, you know, if you truly want to be present, or do you want to trust the system, trust the medical process, the physicians and healthcare team? Because the things you see will last, and you are going to be susceptible to this second victim syndrome, mm-hmm. and may develop that PTSD from your time in the hospital.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I use that airplane oxygen mask analogy, you know, that we've heard. So like before you can go take care of others well, you need to make sure your oxygen mask is on first, or you could pass out trying to help somebody else, you know, so you can easily get burnt out in this situation.
That's true for so many situations. And you're right, Stephen. Now's the time to lean into your family members and friends for support. Ask for help and be specific about what you need. A meal, groceries, pickup, watch the kids, check on the house, a ride, etc. Don't let yourself get burnt out. There are social workers available also that can be a very helpful resource for families. Thank you so much, Stephen. I think we covered a lot today, and hopefully our listeners feel like they got a better grasp on exactly what the ICU is and how to hopefully make a potentially very stressful experience more manageable. Well, that ends today's segment. For more IV Drip, head to our website at theivdrip.co or follow us on Instagram at theivdrip_podcast. Email us your questions and comments at info@theivdrip.co or send us a DM. Thank you so much to our listeners. We appreciate you so much for the support. We love hearing from you all, so share with us all of your experience. Have you been a caregiver or had a family member in the ICU? What was that like for you? We want to know. Most importantly, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on all streaming platforms. Leave a review and spread the love.
Okay, Stephen, we end every episode with a quick tip, so I will give you the floor. Take it away.
No pressure. For me, I would highly recommend, it's a documentary. It's entitled Minimalism, a documentary about the important things. And I first saw it back in 2015, and it literally changed my life. Mm. It doesn't mean you have to get rid of all your stuff and live life with one shirt and two pairs of pants, but it really encourages you to focus only on things that you truly care about and that give you pleasure. And in return, after enacting some of these principles, I have a lot more time to devote to family, to friends, to the things I really enjoy, and to just existing unstressed.
What? Where did you watch it? Was it on Netflix?
On Netflix, and I think it's on
YouTube. Okay, because I think my husband saw it too, and he swears he's a minimalist, but yeah.
There's levels to it.
Right, right.
Time to go to that walk-in closet.